This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
Alrighty, welcome to the reboot episode of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and for episode one of the latest iteration of the Awful Announcing Podcast, we have Bomani Jones on the show, who I think is one of the most versatile entertainers in sports media. You got Game Theory on HBO, The Right Time on ESPN, and Bomani, who was a guest on the Awful Announcing Podcast back in 2014, which I think officially allows me to call him a friend of the program. Bomani, thanks for joining us again today. A lot has changed since 2014. Are you even aware that you are a repeat guest on the podcast?
No, I do remember doing it. I just didn't remember that it was 2014.
Yeah, long time ago. So I want to talk a little bit about your path to ESPN, but also your path into sports media, because when you got started, you have a master's in economics, a master's in politics. You're working on your doctorate and you start writing about sports. So at that time, was it a hobby or is it something that you were interested in making a career out of?
Well, I think at that time I was doing more music stuff than I was doing sports. And then coincidentally, me in grad school decided that we were not the greatest mix. Let's just call that a mutual decision, shall we say. And then after that, like in a lot of ways, the ESPN thing kind of fell into my lap. Like after I found out I wasn't going or I had not passed the micro qual, which was basically go find something else to do with your life. I got a call from ESPN about, hey, we'd like you to do more stuff. And then that kind of built into that. But my plan was always to write in some form of fashion. The surprising part was when the sports stuff came around, because I'm not exactly sure how it goes now at this point in time. But then this was before the internet had kind of opened the door as to who could get the jobs. And so at that point, I'm 24, 25 years old. I haven't done the thing where you cover the high schools. And I really don't want to do the thing where you cover the high schools. Like, I didn't want to do all those introductory steps, I readily admit. And I just got lucky that in the expansion of the net and people kind of looking for different approaches and different ways to go about sports that didn't require you to have that nuts and bolts journalism training, I was able to get in at that point.
Yeah, so you were building a digital following. And even when you started radio, you were kind of prioritizing a streaming audience before radio prioritized that streaming audience. You're hosting a podcast before everybody has a podcast. So like, were you just taking advantage of where you could build an audience, or was that having some foresight into a shift of where the industry was headed eventually?
Well, when I was working in Raleigh and I was trying to do the podcast stuff, it was interesting because I couldn't get them to understand what was going on. But the rationale on their end made sense. They weren't making any money off of this digital stuff. They made money off of that ratings book. They made money off of people saying, we listened to this on the radio. And so they wanted to induce as many people as possible to listen on the radio. But for my own personal goals, my own personal aims, why would I not want to send this stuff out if I can't? Right. Why would I not want to provide access to it to people who aren't necessarily in the market? Now, my bosses are saying we sell ads to the market, so we don't care about this, all of which makes perfect sense. But for me, if I was going to go somewhere, I needed to give people access to what it was that I was doing and give them a chance to go ahead and hear it. So in a lot of ways, it was personal. But then when I started working for the station in Canada, the Sirius station, the whole reason I went there was because they had a massive podcasting operation and I knew that I would be able to distribute my work to a bunch of people. And I think where, particularly in that time, I think I was correct about it. It may be a little bit different then. I mean, different now, but I did not look at the digital product and the analog product as being substitutes for one another. If you could listen to the show on the radio, you would listen to the show on the radio. If you cannot listen to the show on the radio, well, okay, cool. I got this thing for you. That was the way that I was looking at it at that time. And I think that for where we were in the industry at that time, it probably made sense.
How long were you doing the Canada show? That was the score?
Yeah, I did that for a year, coming up on 2 years, but it was about a year and a half.
And how much of it was a local audience?
In the very beginning, the audience was very much so local. But through my own little independent podcast and operation that I was running, I had built an audience that was all over the place.
Right.
And that was in part because I had figured out the Twitter game pretty quickly and then was using this to put stuff out on Twitter, put the stuff out on Facebook. But I do remember very clearly when I did the first day on The Score, they were able to put together a promo for the next day that was all the people calling, glad you're back, glad you're back, glad you're back. And so a lot of it was local, certainly. Like when we would look up, even to this day, when we look up the stats for the Right Time podcast, it's still a heavy North Carolina lean.
Yeah. Do you miss doing local radio?
There's a component to local radio that I miss. Like there's an intimacy to it that I absolutely did miss having. Like I missed the phone calls. I missed talking to people who would call up regularly 3, 4, 5 times a week. I missed having that. There's something to be said for having an audience where you know exactly what it is that they want to talk about. You know how to get there, and you're part of the culture that they want to hear about. So like if Carolina Duke was last night, not only do you know everybody wants to talk about Carolina Duke, hell, you want to talk about Carolina Duke. That's what you were doing all day long yesterday. And I think that when you're doing local, you are a member of the tribe in a way that you, not even with a podcast, do I think that you can really replicate what it is to be part of doing it local. Because with the podcast, yeah, it's community, but by and large, it's built around you, right? It's not built about something bigger than you. And so when you're doing local, what you're doing typically is about something that is bigger than you.
I think the caller thing with radio is such a, it's almost like a controversial topic inside sports radio in terms of whether hosts like taking calls or dislike it. Like some hosts just absolutely hate it. I'm in the Northeast where New York is built on callers. I'm actually surprised that in North Carolina, was that something that the station, did they have a policy of taking calls, or is that something that you just preferred?
No, at the time, the station, I think Opinions and Callers was one of the taglines of the station at the time. They don't really do it like that so much no more.
Yeah.
But at the time, the caller part was big. But for me, I recognized that part of why you wanted callers was you wanted the listener to feel themselves in the show. Like you wanted to reflect the audience, give them a bit of a voice. There was that part. The other part for me is any place that I did a show that had callers or anything like that, I attract really interesting people who call.
Yeah.
And so the callers themselves wound up becoming characters in a different way.
Yeah.
And not in the format where a lot of shows where you got your call screener who really is going through and, you know, meticulously figuring out who's worth getting on the air or not. I'd be like, throw anybody on. If they're bad, throw them off. If they're good, it's about to be magic.
Did you take calls on the ESPN radio show, the national show?
Yes, we did. They're not nearly as much fun. Like that I would say, like the ones that
less
came
consistent
with me,
I'm sure also
correct, like those who came with me, okay, cool, then we could have something. But like a national syndicated audience, unless you really had years to cultivate your crew of people, the caller game was not nearly as much fun there.
You've been with ESPN for about 20 years in various capacities. Obviously, a lot of changes have occurred within the company in that time. The company just had another round of layoffs. As a longtime employee, what's your level of concern every time ESPN has one of those waves?
Personal concern, none. And it's not because I think I'm untouchable. For me, it's just kind of, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. Like I'm not, especially at this point, you know, after all this time, I'm not, that's not something that typically or generally causes me a great level of concern. It's always worrisome just because of how it affects the people that you wind up meeting
sure.
and knowing over time. Like that's the one for me. It's just, it's disappointing in that way, because this is real life for a lot of people and a lot of people who haven't made as much money as I have. So like you lay me off tomorrow. All right, cool. I'll figure it out.
Right.
Not everybody really has that same luxury in that way. But now this happens every few years where they kind of look around and then you personally look at what it is with your contract or how long it's going to be or how much money you're making for this person or that person or everything else. But I find myself more concerned with some of the people I know and the people around me, because like, if you know, you can generally do the math on these things and figure out who it is that they are probably going to come for. I guess I probably fit closer to the who you're going to come for demographic than I ever had previously. But, you know, you worry for those people, especially, you know, the ones you know think it can't happen to them. And,
yeah.
you know, it just might, buddy. It just might.
ESPN radio was hit pretty hard, especially behind the scenes. So as somebody that hosted nationally drive time on ESPN radio for a bit, what do you think the future holds for that platform?
So that's a tricky one for me to answer because I haven't had a car in 6 years.
Okay.
Right. Like I live in New York. To me, radio overall, not specific to ESPN.
Yeah.
For me personally, radio has become less relevant than it has ever been. But I also live in a city that I'm not from and I don't have a car. Like I'm not in a position to be the person who actually listens to radio. I do think that the podcast, the availability and accessibility of podcasts has made things trickier for that radio audience, if only because they're like, that's not the only game in town to get local sports, not just sports generally, but local sports. Now there are more ways for people to consume local, and the audience will always prefer local over national. And so I know for myself personally, when I was doing ESPN radio, the dilemma for me is, how exactly am I supposed to do a show in this time slot that is attractive to the entire country full of people, right? Like, what is it that we could talk about that everybody in America wants to talk about, but they can't get locally? That's a really, really, really hard thing to do. And I think that that's a dilemma that just about everybody faces in this industry. Like, if you're going to make a national sports show work, it really comes down to the dedication of the people behind it saying, we're going to make this work. Like, you take Mike and Mike, for example. The decision was made. They were going to make that work. And they made it work. Colin is a little bit different to me. And I guess Jim Rome also fits this in a way where they weren't trying to reinvent the wheel on this one. They're like, the thing that we could talk about all the time that all of America cares about, football. So we're going to give you all the football you want. I'm a person that probably gets bored talking about football all the time. That's not how they get down. They can get it. They can go. But there's just not a lot of ways for you to appeal to that type of audience. Like across the board, it's really, really, really hard to pull off a national radio show in this day and age.
So did you find that when you were hosting that you had that support? Like, did you not think that ESPN was all in on your show?
No. All in? No. I wouldn't say they were out necessarily. Yeah. That kind of thing, like for me at least, kind of fluctuated depending upon who was in charge. Some people were more enthusiastic than others. Like I can point to one superior who definitely, I think, felt invested to making this work. And then that person was replaced by somebody else who at times it felt like was dedicated to getting me up out the paint. And I could look around and see things and be like, oh yeah, no. This is not getting the support from upstairs that I would like. Like, I don't even tell this story very often, but I went up there to Bristol one time. Now, you know what? I'll save that for the memoir.
Well, come on. Give me something.
Oh, no, I'll tell you. I mean, it happened. Yeah, go ahead. Like, I don't know how they do things now with the studio, but I walked in and they always had these big movie posters for all the shows and for a lot of shows that weren't even on anymore, right? So you could go up there, like I'm trying to think, like Eric Casilius, for example. Like, I don't know if there was a poster for him, but they'd be there. And I remember when I had gone up there and I'd seen the poster for my show and I was like, oh, that's really cool. And I came back at some point, I think this is maybe like 2017, and I'm looking on the walls and I don't see mine. And I'm like, oh, okay. I don't really think much of it, but I'm like, oh, I wonder what that's about. And then somebody looked over at this one poster and they saw something and they peeled down the corner of it and eventually peeled it back. And somebody had taped over the poster for my show with one for something else. They just put another one on top of it. That doesn't make you feel like whoever's in charge there is invested in your success. In,
yeah. Did you comment on it or question it or
like? Not really. Like I think whoever was the person on like physically there at the time came and gave me some like, what do you say if you're the other, if you're the boss on the other side? What do you say? There's nothing for you to say. And on my end, what am I going to do? Whine about a poster?
Right.
You know, like all. The only thing there is for me to say in that situation is I take this as a reflection of something greater and problematic, but that ain't going nowhere, right?
Yeah.
What I'm gonna do, sit in there and cry about it? Like, look, if somebody couldn't stand to see my face for whatever reason, like I wasn't even in there. If somebody couldn't stand to see my face, then fine. They couldn't stand to see my face. But, you know, you look at it and you know, there is somebody here, whoever it is. By the way, the thing that they pasted over me with was something that wasn't even on the air no more. So, like, I think it was a podcast. Like, it wasn't even a radio show. But it was somebody just walked up there and just decided, we don't want to look at you no more.
How much longer were you on the air after that?
Not long. Probably about 5-6 months. But I think something that has been misreported by dishonest people over the last 6 years about this is when High Noon was coming around, I was like, look, I want to put my energy toward this television show, and I would like to transition from doing this radio show to doing a podcast. And they agreed. I don't think anybody put up that much of a fight over me doing it. You know, I don't want to pretend as though people were throwing themselves in front of the train to stop it.
Yeah.
But I decided, my agent and I looked around and were just like, look, it's a better use of time, and it's probably better for me to take this to a podcast rather than doing radio. This wasn't a situation where they canceled it in spite of the fact that some people may not have wanted to see my face. We made that call on our end, and it was one of the best decisions I think we've ever made.
Do you think that it was headed down the road of being canceled, though?
No. Maybe. This is one thing I find when people talk about what was going on with my radio show is ain't nobody ever gave a damn this much about an ESPN radio show that came on after 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
As people seem to care about a claim. Was it headed toward cancellation? I don't have any reason to believe why. Nobody ever had any conversation with me. I was like, oh, buddy, you're in trouble. When I was doing that and the times where I would get the ratings, everybody was falling. There was just a time where the network itself was trying to figure out how to hold on to the people they had. And every slot seemed to be falling. The ones I remember is where everybody was falling and we were holding flat. My disagreement that I had while working in radio there was, and I get where they were coming from, was that they make money off of these ads on terrestrial. And so they're trying to figure out how you can come up with this show again that's going to serve the entirety of your terrestrial audience, which is incredibly difficult, especially in the PPM era. This is just really, really hard for you to pull off. But I'm looking at our numbers. I'm like, yo, we're doing really well on digital and we're doing really well on Sirius. My outlook is it is your best bet to serve the audience you have rather than to chase the audience that you don't. But that's not how those people make money and how everybody gets promoted. So they weren't going about it in that way. And so, I look at what I'm doing and I'm like, if this is attractive on digital and attractive on Sirius, then we need to go to a place where those are the people we serve. Or I don't have to deal with the bullshit from whoever your little local yokel PD is.
Did you have a lot of content freedom when you were hosting ESPN Radio?
I would say yes and no. The freedom is bound by common sense. The content is to serve the audience. The content is not to serve my whims. It was never a time that I was ever doing anything that I didn't think to myself the audience would find interesting, or I did not think was in line with what was necessary to serve the audience. But I never had a single time ever that somebody told me, don't do that, or you can't do that. That never, ever came up.
What about game theory? I imagine you have a cast of writers with that show.
Yeah.
Do you have a lot of content freedom with HBO?
Yeah, I'm in charge.
Yeah. How is it? Work at, because going from having your podcast where it's all kind of you and then radio is all kind of you and then having a team of support, how do you like that adjustment?
Well, the difficulty of that is the writers are in a bit of a unfair situation in that this isn't writing for most people that you write for in Hollywood, where basically you get to assign a point of view to them. You just write something that you think is good and something that you think fits their voice, and then you give it to them, and then we work it out. People know my bars. They don't heard me rap. They know what it sounds like if it's somebody else doing it and not me. And so the writers who are always trying to write to the voice of the talent now have to do it in a different way than they had before. And what's tricky about that, particularly as specifically being me, a particular sort of black person doing this, is you'd be sending this stuff off to white people very often and be like, cool, go sound like the black guy. No pressure. Right. That's hard as hell. There's a lot that comes with that. And so working with people and watching basically feeding the algorithm, teaching the algorithm, watching them learn how to get to the places that I wanted to be so that I, strapped for time, did not have to basically rewrite what it was that they were giving me. That's a managerial process more than anything else, because creatively, ultimately, in the end, whatever they put forth, I got the right to change it all the way up to the end, you know?
And what about High Noon? How was that in terms of content freedom?
Oh, I mean, there's always content freedom on that. I would make the argument we may have had a little too much content freedom. But I've never been in a place where I felt restricted on freedom of content outside of like notions of decency. That's it.
Why do you think that High Noon didn't generate enough ratings to be long lasting? Was it not given enough time? Was there some sort of disconnect with the audience? Is it even something that you can pinpoint?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. One, the ratings on High Noon weren't bad. Like, they weren't great, but they weren't bad. However, if you look at the timeline of how it went, the contract for me and Pablo to do High Noon started, I want to call it March of 2017. The show didn't get onto the air until June of 2018. So that then means by March of 2019, we're in the 1 year window of people figuring out what to do with contracts and everything else. Now, you also keep in mind that when I signed the contract to do High Noon, I had a pretty robust level of interest outside of this company. So I had as much financial leverage as I'd ever had. So what you then wind up with is at least one host, because I can talk about me. I ain't going to talk about nobody else's money in that way. You got at least one host that's making a lot of money, or at least in their eyes, making a lot of money doing a show that hasn't really developed a foothold yet. And you've got a conversation to be had about renewing the contracts. The president of the company, when these contracts were signed, is no longer the president of the company. And then throw on the next part, and this is what's most important to me, to, I think, to discuss. Rather than people looking at it in the context of ratings, I look at it in the context of, well, how good was the show? And the answer was, yeah, not bad. And no one has to keep a show that's not bad, you know? So you put all of those things together, and yeah, it makes sense that they could look up and say to themselves, yeah, nah, I think that we could move on in another direction, in a cheaper direction. Because when you remember, when they moved us out, the show that they put in that time slot was Jalen and Jacoby, which is to say a show that they were already producing, a show that was already being made. Nobody had to come up with anything new. Nobody had to spend any more money in order to throw it in there. It's just, boom, there's Jalen and Jacoby. And something I don't know personally, but for, you know, the people who have questions about the ratings on High Noon, does anybody know what the ratings of Jalen and Jacoby were after they got in there? Like, does anybody know what the ratings of Sports Nation were before we got there? No. Because that's not really, like, but so much what this is about.
Is there an aspect of having to, like, swallow your pride after a show gets canceled and you're still working for the company? Like, did you ever feel inclined to almost leave ESPN out of spite after losing High Noon?
No, because it wasn't personal. It was a reasonable decision.
Yeah.
Like I can look at it and see what they did and see why they did it. And also just as an observer of media and watch the show. Yeah, no, there was not for me. Well, also the other part, and this is important. This all happened in March of 2020.
Yeah.
Wasn't no time to be worried about swallowing no pride. It was about getting some checks. And so I remember, I forget what I'd heard being announced. It was when everything was getting shut down. I think it may have been the day the Google offices shut down, because I've been talking to some other people trying to make some stuff happen. And I think it was the day the Google offices shut down. I called my agent and said, take the last offer. I don't care what it was. Just go back there and take it. There wasn't no time for like the oh man, I've got to go back to these places. Nah, that wasn't it. The only thing that bothered me, and this wasn't an ESPN thing, the thing that bothered me was Highly Questionable was still on. And my understanding is that they were trying to save it, right? Like the contract was coming up on it. They were trying to save the show. I had also had conversations with higher ups that had led me to believe that once I left High Noon, that I would go back to hosting Highly Questionable 5 days a week with Dan. And that did not happen. And the explanation for why it did not happen was that there were a lot of people who wanted to do TV and they wanted to make sure that they had some place that they could go do TV, which is something I did not give a single solitary fuck about, nor do I think I should have, nor do I think they should have. That was the only thing that I found to be like maybe required a measure of swallowing pride is, like, Highly Questionable was never my show. Let's be clear. It was Dan's show. That ain't my city. That ain't my daddy. Like, all of those things. That was Dan's show. I never had any measure of resentment for that. But you can go back and look at the last episode that I did of Highly Questionable, and you can talk to anybody who was involved in it. And to a man, they say, me showing up on Highly Questionable saved that show from being canceled. And it didn't just save it from being canceled. It went from being a show that was on ESPN2 to the first of the shows that migrated from ESPN2 over to ESPN. And the ratings that it ultimately got while Dan, Poppy, and I did it got to levels that nobody ever thought that they would get to. And then I come back and you throw me into a rotation. And nah, that bothered me. That's the one that, I mean, I did it, but that's the one that bothers me. And honestly, probably affected some relationships that came up subsequent, because I just thought that was a ridiculous decision. And I did not.
Are you surprised that Dan didn't have enough pull to say, no, I want Bomani to be on there?
No, it's not about Dan having enough pull. The thing about the situation at that time was Dan, given how Dan operates, Dan was a person who always wanted to make sure that all these people got taken care of, because who knows what he had in his mind about what his future plans were and everything else. So Dan was trying to be the nice guy and, you know, get all his friends on in these various capacities. My problem was I felt like there were people higher up than him who were supposed to say, yeah, so what? Right. So Dan wants to do this one way. I understand it. That's his call. That's his decision. I never had any problems with him about that. I had problems with the people who I thought were in a capacity where they should have told him, oh, well, we're trying to save this TV show. Like, if you're trying to save it, save it. If you're not, look out for your people.
Do you feel underutilized by ESPN on TV?
No. Well, I mean, let's be honest here. I'm not utilized at all by ESPN on TV at this point. But I don't have a problem with that. I mean, look at the network. Look at what they air. Look at the types of programs that they're doing. Where is there for somebody who does what I do? Right? Like the kind of general opinion person that they used to have all over the place and that the shows used to cater to across the board. Where is there? Like on Get Up, if I'm not coming in to fill in as host, what is there for me to do? Go look at who the people are that they typically have with Stephen A. Smith. They're former athletes, insiders, that range of people. That's not what I do. So I don't think of them.
You do. I mean, Le Batard has touted your ability to debate. I'm sure you think of yourself as one of the best people at debating at ESPN. First Take is a debate show. Why aren't you on First Take more?
Well, there's a couple arguments I think that you can make. One, that there's a measure of kind of like skill overlap with me and Stephen A. in that sense, right? Like we fill similar roles, I would say. So I don't know if you get the, like, I mean, I went up there and talked to him about Deion Sanders or whatever it is, you know, when that stuff was going on. So yeah, I could be on First Take. Good at debate is an amorphous, tricky term. Like Stephen A's better at doing that on television than anybody else. If you want to take this to the cards, right, and have the judges evaluate who's won this thing, then yeah, I probably can win out on that. But I also don't necessarily enjoy that.
Yeah.
Like that's not quite what I feel like I want to do at this point in my career. So yeah, could they use me more on television? Yeah, maybe, but I don't think it is at all personal that I'm not there, as much as there was a role for somebody like me at that company years ago in a way that it just doesn't exist anymore. They do something different now.
Chris Russo is not a former athlete, but he gets a lot of run on First Take.
Yeah. He's Chris Russo, you know, like that says he's serving a much different purpose than I am. And he is kind of long established in this game and with a relationship with Steven that I don't have. So, yeah, no, that's correct. Like, you know, they have a place for Chris Russo, but that's the one guy we're talking about. Really? They have a place for him on there. Would I want to just go do First Take one day a week? Probably not.
Yeah. Do you think people at ESPN are getting used to Chris Russo's shtick? Because last year it seemed like J.J. Redick, Ryan Clark, Dominic Foxworth, like they didn't want to deal with him. And I grew up listening to WFAN, so like I love Chris Russo, but I can understand former athletes getting tired of him trying to boil every single debate down to how somebody played in their last playoff game or to what happened in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, I do think that there is a measure of get accustomed to it.
Yeah.
That had to take place. I also think that a lot of the athletes looked up and realized that I'm going to come take down Chris Russo isn't nearly as compelling the second or third time.
Yeah.
As you may have thought that it was the first time. And the other part, and I think that this one is important, people like him, like personally. Like, I've only met him one time, so I'm not the best person. My buddy Nick Wright knows him well because he, you know, was on the radio station on Sirius with him. He's a good dude that people like. Like, he's just really, really loud, and you kind of got to get used to the voice and all of that stuff. But it helps that people like him personally, and they realize that whatever he's doing is his thing, but it's not. It's not nearly as confrontational as I think that a lot of them would otherwise believe.
How was debating against Skip Bayless?
Well, what was interesting about it for me, and I haven't done it now in like 13 years, was I misunderstood who I was dealing with. And so I thought that he would find it refreshing that he had a real challenge in front of him. Now, no. That's not it. That's not it. That's a man that thinks he's won every debate he's ever been in, right? And so the first couple times I did the show, I was doing it wrong because I'm not particularly confrontational. That's just not, like, in terms of how I, you know, the back and forth and stuff like that. That's not really how I do. And so they want confrontation. They want that collision. And we had one day I was there. I tell the story not too often, but I was there and somebody sent a text. I think it was Derek Brooks that sent a tweet in and asked Skip Bayless who his toughest opponent to debate was. He was like, oh, easy, Greg Anthony. And I was kind of joking. I'm like, yo, Skip, I'm right here, baby. He was like, Greg Anthony. And I was like, okay. You know, and I'm like, look, I'm not trying to come in this man's TV show, turning over tables, like fighting him. Like, that was my thought the whole way. Like, I ain't trying to do all that. But that day I decided to. And I wore his ass out, just top to bottom. Like, there was just kind of, like, I was wearing his ass out on hood shit. Like, I was wearing this out on, like, high-minded stuff. I was wearing him out on sports stuff. Like, I just came in there dropping blows. That man ain't say a word to me, and they didn't call me again to come debate with Skip Bayless. And so the tricky thing about doing that with Skip is, if you're not somebody that knows him very well, he's not really talking with you. He's so locked in personally. Like, this means something different to him than it means to other people.
Yeah.
And he's so locked into whatever it is that he's doing that you're not going to get a lot of interaction. And then if what you say to him is not something he expected or he can rock with, this whole thing's just going to shut down.
You were very complimentary to Skip earlier this year when you were with on House of Strauss. And at the time, not many people were complimentary of Skip because it was shortly after the Damar Hamlin tweet and some of his blow ups with Shannon Sharp. I'm also kind of surprised that after knowing that Skip stopped calling you back to First Take, that you're still complimentary of his ability to be on TV and host a debate show, even though it's like he says he wins every debate, but he doesn't necessarily want somebody that he can't beat in a debate on with him. Like, that seems kind of I would think that you'd be a little bit more critical of him basically after that.
Yeah, but I mean, that does not change how good he is at doing a television show in that format. So, like, one, the Damar Hamlin tweet, everybody else was wrong. Skip was not. Every single person that came and brought that hammer down on Skip was wrong. That was the ridiculous outrage machine of social media looking for somebody to gang up on, and they found the guy to gang up on, and it was Skip Bayless. Now, the argument against Skip in that case is that he is a professional communicator and he did not communicate in a way that was very clear to everybody. And maybe you could say that that was his fault, but all he was saying was the same thing. I could have said the same exact thing Skip said, and people wouldn't have brought it to me because people don't feel the way about me that they feel about Skip, which is very simply, they can't keep playing this game. However, they can't stop this game. What in the world are they to do? What's this going to be? And I think that people assume that just because Skip can be a bit of a jerk, that he's like some kind of callous, bad dude, which is absolutely 100% not the case about him from my experience with him. Before I did First Take with him, and when we both worked at Page Two, he would email. He was always very, very nice to me and all of those things. But no matter how it is that I feel about him personally, that does not change the fact that you ain't never seen that man stutter on television, not once. Like, say what you want about Skip, but if you're going to do the kind of television that he does, what makes him so good is that He takes a very strong and clear position every time, and you know exactly where it is that he's coming from. You may not agree with what he says, but there is no confusion or mystery about what he was talking about. I'll give you another example of somebody very, very good on television that people think that just because they don't like him that they're not good at television. Jay Mariotti on Around the Horn. You go back and watch those clips of Mariotti. There's a reason they were putting him on television every day. The man spoke clearly. The man never stammered, and you knew exactly where he was coming from, no matter what the topic was. And that's how I feel about Skip. And so for me, no, I will never have a problem saying what's true about somebody. And, you know, that's what it is with him. There are all kinds of negative things. If you want to say him about Skip, you can. But ain't nobody putting him on television as a favor. He is a legitimate pioneer for the journalist trying to figure out how to turn himself into somebody bigger than their newspaper, bigger than their publication, and then make the transition into doing his television stuff. Skip is one of the rare people who ever truly mattered at ESPN. And what I mean by mattered is Jamie Horowitz comes in, looks at the ratings of Cold Pizza at the time, or First Take at the time, and it's like, yo, the ratings spike when Skip's on. The whole show should be Skip. This network doesn't do that for people very often, right? They're not telling anybody that you're the star. But there was no other option with him because it was so clear, because he really is that good at this.
So why do you think people are always so quick to try to pile on? Is it because he says that he never loses a debate?
Nah.
Is it because some of the brash comments that he's made over the years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a bit insufferable. I'm not going to pretend as though insufferability is not part of it. But and he's an easy target, and he takes it. You know, like, he'll come on. Like, one thing about it, you don't hear Skip complain that much about the way people are mean to him.
Yeah.
You know, from my experience with him and from talking to other people, he does find it get a bit confusing that he's the one guy that everybody comes down on in that way. But no, he is an incredibly, incredibly easy target. And it's like the thing that everybody can get, you know, can get together on is how much they don't like Skip. I'm just not one of those people.
Yeah. This is a big hypothetical, but say Skip and Shannon did end up divorcing earlier this year after some of their on-air blowups. Would you have been interested in teaming up with Skip Bayless for a debate show?
No.
Is that because of Skip, or is that just that format just is not something that appeals to you?
I don't really want to do that. I am not particularly interested at this point, and maybe something will change, but the idea of, hey, we're going to put you with a co-host, I don't think I want to do that again.
What do you think about Stephen A. Smith starting to pivot a little bit into politics and the new podcast that he has?
I mean, if that's what he wants to do, I haven't really listened to the podcast. I've heard, you know, some of the snippets that they put online, but I don't see any reason for him not to do that. And I think, I mean, we've known this for a long time about Stephen A. His ambitions have always been bigger and grander than sports. And, you know, it's a kind of a new world order at the company, with them allowing people to do things that are outside of the company, or allowing him to do a podcast like that. And so I wish him the best on it. I'm interested. I mean, he has talked about having, you know, people approaching him about going into politics. I would not be surprised at all to see him actually do it like that. In fact, I may be more surprised, more surprised than not, if he were to not go into politics.
Really?
At this point. Look, man, he's really, really, really famous. Like, I don't think that's something that can really easily be explained to people. It's just what the magnitude of Stephen A. Smith is at this point in time. And if he decided to run, I would not be terribly surprised. I don't have any idea whether or not he could win. I don't know where he would run. I don't know any of those things. But it wouldn't shock me at all if he decided he wanted to run for office.
Is that something, though, that do you think he would have to start at like a local level in running for office, or
right, how local are you talking?
Could you see him running for governor? Like, I don't know that.
I could.
Oh, really?
I could see him doing that. I don't know if that would be the wisest idea necessarily.
Right. Yeah.
But I
sure.
could see him doing that. I could see him running,
jumping
for the
right
house.
Into something like that.
Yeah. Like, I could see him running for the house. Like, but he moves like a politician, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but he moves like a man that knows that everybody's looking at him, and that when he talks, everybody sits up and listens.
Did you have any issue with Stephen A. interviewing Clay Travis? Like, does that bother you? Being that you guys are ESPN colleagues, did that bother you at all?
No. If I were going to have a problem with that, it would. Stephen A. and I are friendly. We are not friends.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's not my homeboy. I'm not going to call him up and chat about the game. if we were, maybe I would view that somewhat differently. But I understand that Stephen A. views himself as a centrist. Like he says this kind of out loud, is that he sees himself as a centrist. And to be a centrist, you kind of have to go in both directions on that. And thereby you wind up talking to Clay Travis.
Were you more surprised that Don Lemon was let go by CNN or Tucker was let go by Fox News this week? Or on the
I do a decent bit of work there with the CNN people. I am not surprised by either, but for very different reasons. I think with Don, it just became a question you ask yourself about fit, right? Fit in what he's doing, fit in where the network is, everything else. Like, I want to be very careful because I don't know too much about the inner workings, but I think that we had read enough things in the trades and seen enough things to not be surprised that somebody would make a decision to move on from him. Like, this is the game. People get let go of, you know, just get let go all the time. With Carlson, again, everything else that swirled, it wasn't terribly surprising. The part with Carlson that I think that gets lost is that for all those ratings, his presence had been so toxic for so long to blue chip advertisers that they wasn't really getting the money out of it that one would think that they should get from such a time slot. And for Fox, it was funny. I had lunch with somebody the day that happened, and I looked at him and I said, "But do you remember who Tucker Carlson replaced?" And he was just like, "Oh, wow, I don't know." And I was like, "It was Bill O'Reilly."
Bill O'Reilly, yeah.
Like, Bill O'Reilly's not a small person, but that easily you could forget. They're going to put somebody else in there, and they can build it back up if they want to, right? So I was actually surprised, given all of what would happen, all the things that had happened with Carlson over the years. I think it's as much a surprise as anything else that this didn't happen sooner. But I think it just, with all the stuff with the lawsuits and everything else, he just became more trouble than he was worth.
Do you have an interest in a bigger role on cable news, or are the occasional CNN hits enough?
It depends. Like, I don't have a answer necessarily on what I mean, I'm a part-time employee at ESPN right now, right? Like, when Game Theory's in season, I do Game Theory. So if somebody comes up to me and they've got something interesting to propose, then yeah, we could talk about it and see what it is. But what I do know at this point in my career, having done Game Theory, things that are creative, things that allow me to build, that allow me to conceive of things, those are the things that I kind of want to get into at this point. So that's why I was like, you know, when you asked the question about being used more at ESPN, I just don't know if that kind of television is what I want to do right now.
Yeah. Last thing, how much do you love and appreciate the aggregate media?
I mean, they make my life a lot easier in the sense that I can like mess around and find out something that's going on right quick.
Do you like the headlines that we write about you?
I generally, it's not that often that I find a headline about me that I find that problematic, right? What I'm always surprised by is that anybody wants to read about me. Like, that's the strangest thing in the world to me.
I think they want to read about your opinions.
But there's a cottage industry of just like the coverage of sports media, like even like the entirety of the site that you work for.
Yeah.
It blows my mind that this site can exist and be profitable. Like, clearly it can, and clearly you guys get it, but people care about the people in our industry in a way that they don't elsewhere. I think that it's a function of the fact that we talk about sports and transactions all the time. Like, the people who cover the music industry aren't sitting around like, "Yo, somebody got dropped from their contract this week." Like, it doesn't work that way. Like, you don't have wires that, you know, that move like this does. So as a result, people talk about us the same way. And so I don't necessarily mind the headlines. I just always worry whether or not the person who is doing the aggregating actually gets my point and if they are providing adequate context to what it is that I've said. I have less problem with the aggregating media than I have with people who work in social media at these sites or at these shows or whatever that then decide that they want to push the content.
Yeah.
They're the ones that I have a problem with because they're the sociopaths looking for hits and the indifference very often of whoever it is that is a guest on their show. Like, I'll give an example. I did something once with Dan, and I forget what we were talking about, something, it was the Brian Flores thing or whatever it was, and it was a classic interview with white person, and they're like, what has to change to fix the problems of the league? And I was like, yeah, white people are what's got to change. And my fundamental point was and remains, racism is a white people problem. Like, there's nothing, like, they always ask a black person, what can we do to fix this? As if we didn't have the magic solution, we wouldn't have been done that, right? Like, we have the greatest incentive to figure it out. No, it's white people. Was I saying that white people are the only problem in the world? No, it wasn't any of those things. But the Levitard people just thought the clip was funny. And so they're just like, first of all, again, leaning on it for the idea that it's funny, not the fundamental point.
Yeah.
And so they put this clip out that's just, what's the problem? White people. So you know who gets a hold of that, right? And so now I got people calling my bosses and everything else and making this a thing. And then I go do CNN that night and they're like, ah, yeah, you know, we, you know, as they people doing, saying da, da, da. And I'm like, we ain't got to talk about these people, right? We don't have to take them seriously. But I have greater problems when people who run something or run some outlet that you have given your time to for free to do, you know, to do something with them. And they don't look out for you
yep.
in terms of how they present the content after the fact. Had another one where I had to fix this because I had this happen when I went on CNN and I started talking about Deion Sanders and they put the clip out and the cry on was their initial question that I dismissed myself, which was, is Deion Sanders a sellout? Like that's what's reading under the screen. Nothing I say in that viral clip really gets heard because all they see underneath is Deion Sanders a sellout, right? And so now I got friends calling me like, hey, Deion's son called me and want to know if it was okay that you called his dad a sellout. And I'm like, go listen to it. I didn't call his dad a sellout, right? So where it got weird for me after that is then Dan Patrick's show, which I've been on a few times, they put out a clip where Dan had misunderstood because of the Cryon thing, I mean, the Chiron thing, right? And he asked Marcellus Wiley, well, Bomani Jones says Deion Sanders is a sellout. And then Marcellus is talking about me being a sellout, me saying Deion's a sellout. And then he's talking about me saying that Deion's a sellout. And I never said that thing, you know? So I called Dan's people and I was just like, hey, man, all the stuff I just said right there. And they're like, yeah, we corrected Dan. I'm like, yeah, but then it went out on social. And they're like, oh, didn't realize that happened. We'll take it down. You see what I mean? But so it winds up, I have more problems with the outlets that someone like me can appear on not being protective of enough of their guests when they then like when it happened with Levitard, I called a social guy and I was just like, hey man, you know, look, I know you didn't mean nothing by it. You know, like I know you weren't thinking of it that way, but you just got to keep in mind that I need y'all to look out for me when it comes to this. Because you guys have the control. And that is more of a concern to me than the aggregators.
All right, noted. So we'll try to take extra caution with the clips that we put out from this podcast.
I'd appreciate that.
All right, Bomani, thanks a lot. I've kept you long enough, but you've been awesome.
No, man, I appreciate it. I'm going to throw a little plug myself. Check out The Right Time with Bomani Jones podcast. We got nominated for a Webby. We'll find out in May whether or not we win said Webby. I think Draymond probably beat us out for the People's Choice element of that. But no, that's been, if there's been a joy of this pandemic, it has been watching that podcast kind of do rocket ship things.
Good stuff. All right. And this is the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm Brandon Contis. Thanks for listening. Be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.